Let me share, and I have probably told you bits and pieces, so you know a lot of this anyway, but there's a period in my own life where I was not walking with God, pleasing Him, worshiping Him, getting to know Him, were definitely not on my radar. They were not what I was pursuing. In fact, ignoring Him was probably more to the point of where I was at. Running from Him may have been a good definition of what was going on in my life. And then God brought this series of things, but a key point was that God brought this young guy, actually about a year older than I was, maybe two, into my life, named Leotis Crawford. And Leotis was a fairly new believer, but he's one of those guys that just, you know, he was so far away from God prior to understanding how much God loved him and accepting that gift. But he's kind of like the Apostle Paul. When he turned directions, he was 100%. And so God brought Leotis in my life, and he challenged me. And because of his influence, him causing me to re-examine where I was and the direction I was heading. And frankly, I got to tell you, I was pretty miserable anyway, because I mean, I grew up in a preacher's house, so I kind of knew what I should be doing. But I'll be forever grateful to him for stepping in my life and for the way God used him in my life. And it's really interesting. Not long after that, we moved. At the time, we lived in California. We moved from California to Colorado, back to Colorado. We'd been, several of my dad's churches had been in Colorado, but we moved back to Colorado, up near Evergreen, Colorado. And so it was kind of a fresh start. It was one of those things, I often think that, I'm sure God had all kinds of reasons, but one of the reasons was to give me an opportunity to fresh start. Because I had the friends I hung with back in California, and I really needed to make a clean break from that. So we moved there, and I began to make friends. Some of my new friends were believers. Some were not. But my heart, because of what God was doing it, my heart regarded, especially those friends that didn't know the Lord, was I wanted them to know God. I wanted them to know about His love for them and His grace for them. And I remember this one girl. We became good friends, and I really sensed that she might be close. And I wanted her to come know my God, and I kept inviting her to come to church with me. And finally, she gave in. She gave in to the pressure. She said, "Okay, I'll come this Sunday." And I said, "Well, I'll meet you in the parking lot." I told her what time church was, and so I was out there, and when it was time, and she showed up. Now, you need to know that all my time of knowing her, I had never seen her in anything except jeans or bib overalls. That's what she wore. That's what we all wore back in those days, and with lots of patches usually. So when she stepped out of her car, when she came to church, I was kind of surprised because she didn't have jeans on or overall. She had a dress on, or a skirt on. So someone had told her that if you're going to go to church, you're supposed to wear a skirt. And so she stepped out and she had this skirt on. She was trying to do the right thing. She was trying to dress up for church. The problem was it was a very, very, maybe very short skirt. And so, interestingly enough, the moment we stepped into church, I regretted that I'd asked her to come with me. I immediately saw these looks coming from people that I loved and cared a lot, that were giving a clear impression that they were not happy about the way this girl was dressed. Looks of disgust, distaste. I saw self-righteousness that had totally lost perspective of what was going on here. And it was a hard moment for me. It was a good moment because it was an awakening moment for me. Listen to this quote from Eugene Peterson's book called The Slant, or Tell It Slant. "There is one form of sin that flourishes in religious communities in ways hardly possible outside of them. It begins in places of worship. Religious communities provide the conditions for this spiritual disorder, this sin, far in excess to what is provided in the secularized world. The common name for the sin is self-righteousness. In order to take root, and listen to this, this is really interesting. In order to take root, it requires the soil of a community in which righteousness is honored and pursued. You get that? For self-righteousness to take root, it needs the soil of a community that really values righteousness, which is, I want to be in right standing before God, that holds that in a high value. That's a good thing. But in the midst of that is where self-righteousness often takes root. Without a community in which righteous ways are practiced, self-righteousness would not be possible. Interesting. The pursuit of something good, righteousness, right standing before God, ends up as something bad, or can. Self-righteousness, the pursuit of living in a way that is right and good and godly and pleasant and loving, ends up instead in a place of arrogance and pretending and judgmental attitudes and mean-spirited looks and sometimes actual words. How does that happen? I'm not sure we're going to answer that question this morning, but we're going to come back around to it in a sense a little later in this time together. I suspect you have your opinions about that, and I have mine, regarding how easy it is for us to forget how gracious God has been in our life, to start believing our own press, you know? Start believing that, well, yeah, I know I needed God in the beginning, but it's kind of lucky to have me now that I've got my act together. You know, it's really easy to start to forget the grace and mercy of God. And even though we had never say it out loud, we start thinking that we deserve certain things. We deserve more. And so that's a problem. Self-righteousness, though, is not a new problem. In fact, go with me over to Luke chapter 12, because that's where we're going. Or Luke chapter 15, that's where we're going this morning. Gospel of Luke chapter 15. And we're going to find out that you knew it anyway. It's an age-old problem. Now, if you're paying attention, you notice that we skipped, because we were back in chapter 13 last week, and now we've skipped all the way up to chapter 15, and there's a couple of reasons for that. I've got to pick and choose, or we'll be doing parables for a long time. And I know my attention span, and yours too. It's eventually you say, okay, I like this, but let's move on to something else. So we'll hit several of the parables, but won't hit them all. But let me just do a little bit of it. There are some things that you know, as you walk through the rest of chapter 13 and 14, that I ought to note anyway. You know, it's interesting because one of the parables that was in chapter 13, excuse me, verses 18 and on, is actually the parable that our name for our mustard seed offering came from. It's a parable of the mustard seed, and we're not going to read it this morning, but it's a parable of, he talks about this seed that's so small. In that day, it was considered one of the tiniest seeds. It was not, they didn't have microscopes to identify that. So for them, it was one of the tiniest seeds. If you saw them, you would say to yourself, this can't amount to much because it's too small. And yet it would make this tree that he talks about. He says that the birds actually come in and find shelter and safety and protection. And so God takes these things that you look at and you say, boy, I don't know. Can anything, is this going to really work? Can this happen? Can this make it? Can this? And God takes these small things and does unbelievable things. And if you're wise enough to look back, you start putting the pieces together and you realize, wow, we're experiencing some of that stuff right now where God's just, he's way out ahead of us, you know, and we're just trying to keep up and follow the best we can. And so that parable is where that came from. And that's how our idea was, you know, Lord, through your people, we don't know what you're going to do, but it's going to be interesting to see, you know, the gifts that came in and how close they're going to be to the down payment we need. It looks like it's going to be pretty much God knew what he was doing there. I don't know, but so that's what God does. And so that's one of the parables that he walks through. And then in chapter 14, another one that we skipped, he tells a parable of this wealthy man who throws this banquet. And he has a lot of, this guy's, you know, his friends are the prestigious guys, the the movers and shakers, the power players, the power brokers in the community. And so he invites all these individuals who he thinks are his friends and to this banquet. It's going to be a big celebration. They're going to have a great time together. And one after another give an excuse. For whatever reason, they don't want to come. And then it was, you know, you can tell because their excuses aren't good excuses. They're kind of dumb excuses, you know. Like you had that happen where you ask somebody to do something and they say, oh, yeah, Tuesday night, I think I have something that night. And you're going, well, first of all, I said Thursday night. And, you know, so it's kind of that kind of thing going on. And so this wealthy man, he says, okay, fine. And he sends his servants out. He says, go and pick the people from the streets, the people that are the outcasts. They're never going to amount to anything. They're, you know, whatever. And bring them in because I want to have a celebration. And I want this banquet hall to be full. And so they go out and they gather these people together. Well, then word gets out. This is going to be a pretty cool gathering. And so those wealthy, prestigious people start thinking, no, I'd like to go. He says, no, no way. So, you know, it's going to be interesting when we get to heaven. Who we're expecting to see that's not there? And who's there that we thought, there's no way in the world I ever thought, you know, you and I'd be in this place together. So we missed some of those. We skipped those. Go back and read them. And maybe, Lord willing, someday down the road we'll get to spend a little time on those. But today I wanted to move into chapter 15 and talk a little bit about, actually, the whole chapter, several parables. But here's where it starts. And here's the insight. And this is what sets the stage for this whole conversation. I'm not sure I totally understood this prior to getting ready for this discussion this morning. But let me read verses 1 and 2. Chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners. He eats with them. Now there's some interesting things going on in these opening verses that lead up to today's parables that we're going to look at. One, as you hear, the crowd of followers that are walking with Jesus as he walks through Samaria is growing. They're attracting more people. Unfortunately, at least from some of the crowd's perspective, the people that are being attracted are the undesirables, the unclean, they don't dress right, they don't talk right, they don't act right, they've been involved in things in their life that, you know, they shouldn't have been, and we don't really want to associate them. Those are the people that are starting to be attracted to walk with Jesus and hear his story and his messages as they walk along. They're the tax collectors and the sinners. It's interesting to me. I don't know of a church that doesn't say one of our major goals as a church is to attract the lost to Christ. Every church says that until they start coming. Until they start walking in the door, and then all of a sudden it's not just a statement, it's a reality. And all of a sudden we realize that the people that God is drawing to himself, as he always said he would, are the ones that are hurting, that are struggling, that have heartache, that have pasts that are not very pretty pasts, and have problems and issues and hang-ups and addictions. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, wait a minute, I guess I didn't think this through. I didn't realize that's what the lost would look like. And it looks like the wealthy and the ones who think they have it all together. And it's all part of it. And suddenly we discovered that we're really not all that comfortable hanging with the tax collectors and the sinners. But Jesus always was. And that was troubling to the religious folks. They had questions about why do they like to be around Jesus? Why does he like to be around them? Is there something about him that we don't know that makes them gravitate to them, towards him? Is there some kind of a dark secret in his past that they picked up on that we haven't, that makes them comfortable hanging with him? There is a secret. But it wasn't deep and it wasn't dark and it wasn't supposed to be hidden. It's supposed to be good news that is shared broadly and openly and with arms that say, come. And that's where Jesus was. And that's why they loved him. That's why they were attracted to him. Because when they talked to Jesus, they found acceptance. They found love. They found grace. And that was attractive to them. They'd never seen that before, especially from a so-called religious individual. And that was remarkable. And so they gravitated towards him. Something else to take note of in these opening verses. You know, the religious teachers that are there, the Pharisees, my suspicion, and not just me, or I wouldn't feel comfortable, but they're followers of Jesus. These are not, you know, we assume, we hear the word Pharisees and we make an assumption. They're just there to cause Jesus problems. I don't think that's the case. He had a number of Pharisees that had become his followers. Now, they were still struggling with this religiosity they'd had all their life. You know, Nicodemus is one of those that you know, in John 3, where he talks about coming. So there were some who followed him. They were not just, they weren't just trying to trap him. Some of them actually were followers. They were trying to learn from him. They saw something in him. And they were on this journey with him. And it wasn't an easy journey. We've talked about this. They're it's not comfortable. They're not in an area that they all love to be. They're walking through enemy territory from their perspective. They're around people and communities that reject them as good Jews, and especially the religious people. So it's not, but it's worthwhile. They want to be with Jesus. But now that he's attracting these people, they're getting a little uncomfortable with this whole thing. They're starting to second guess him. Why would those kind of people want to hang with Jesus? And it's causing them to start to struggle. So Jesus, from this murmuring that he overhears or knows what's going on, begins to walk into these parables. And all these parables in chapter 15, everyone in this room is very familiar with. You've studied them, you've heard, even if you've never cracked the Bible, you've heard about some of these. You have the parable of the shepherd. And he has 100 sheep, but one of them gets lost, and he goes out and he's looking everywhere for this lost sheep. And he finally finds it. When he does, he calls all of his friends together and they have this time of celebration because he found this lost sheep. And then the second parable he tells is a story about a woman who had these 10 coins. And you know, the assumption is 10 silver coins, this is probably all she has. And she probably counts them every day because this is what she falls back on. This is what's going to make it for her. And so she's counting it this one day, and she's one short, and she's panicking. So she looks everywhere for this coin, and she finally finds it. And when she finds it, she's so excited that she found the lost coin that she calls her friends together, and they have this big celebration. And it's funny, with the first one, the shepherd, he ends with this statement. He says, I tell you that in the same way there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. And then at the end of the coin story, he says, in the same way I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So he's saying, here's God's perspective. Those are illustrations of God's heart when it comes to a person who finally says, oh, I need what God's offering. He says there's rejoicing that goes on, not only here on earth, but in heaven. And so he's pointing to God's heart for the lost in those two initial parables. And he's using analogies, pictures of things that they would understand, every one of them. But then he moves into the next parable, which is probably the most famous of all his parables, the parable of the lost son, or some of your Bibles will say the prodigal son. And I want to read those verses. So starting with verse 11, chapter 15, follow along as I read verses 15 down through 32. Chapter 15, starting with verse 11, and 11 through 32. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come home. Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fat calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you killed the fat calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours, but we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" Let me make some quick observations as we start walking down through this parable. We're not going to look at all the parable, but most would say, and I've probably preached this way in the past, that in this chapter 15, there are three parables, three stories of things that are lost. There's the lost sheep, there's the lost coin, and there's the lost son. But in reality, there are four stories. And they're all about the lost. Because not only is the one son lost who returns, but the older brother is also lost. And really, probably, as you put the whole passage together, this is probably the key part of this story. This is where Jesus has been trying to get the whole time, is to talk about that last lost brother. Note the first two parables, and this is kind of interesting. The lost sheep and the lost coin, the owner goes out looking for them. High, low, in, out, up, down, here, there. They look until they find what's lost. Here's something that I found really interesting. The first son, he goes off on his own. What didn't the father do? He didn't go looking for him. That was really intriguing to me. He prayed. He waited. He hoped. He watched. But he didn't pursue that lost son. It wasn't like the sheep. It wasn't like the coin. Now he's watching because the day his son returns, he sees him coming a long ways off. And in fact, he breaks all codes of respectful Jewish elderly men because they didn't ran, they walked. That's where they showed that they were dignified. He didn't care anything about all that because he ran to meet his son. But he doesn't go after him. He doesn't chase him down. He doesn't interfere in his choices or try to protect him from the consequences or pay for the damages. All the things that we do, don't we? You know, I've been there. I've been him, you know? And we have this tendency to think, well, I got to go after him. I got to do these things. I got to protect him. And the father doesn't. Interesting. And this isn't the only time we see this. It's interesting. If you go to 1 Peter chapter 3, a scenario set up there. It's talking about a husband and wife relationship. There's a scenario set up, and it uses the wife. It could have been the husband. It could have been either direction, I believe. But it talks about this wife, and she has a husband who is unbelieving. So that could mean either he doesn't know God at all, or he's walked away from God. And if you look there in 1 Peter 3, he says, okay, to the wife, the tendency is, you know, I need to preach at him. I need to invite him to church. I need to nag a little bit, you know. You should have been there today. You should have heard preach a sermon because it was just for you. I need to put verses on the bottom of his beer cans. I need to do something. I got to do something to get this guy to straighten out. And Peter writes under the inspiration of God, no. Live this quiet, godly life in front of him. Let God do the hard work. And so I find this is really interesting that this prodigal son, the father doesn't go after him. He lets God work on his hearts. And you know, heart changing isn't up to us. And some of you may have some prodigals in your life. And this might be a wise thing for you to ponder for a little bit. What your approach has been. So as this young man runs off, his dad's not around, nobody's preaching at him. But you know what? He's getting the message, isn't he? You see, that's the thing. What's interesting, and having been a prodigal for a while, what's interesting, I told you, I was miserable in those days. And one of the things I admire about my parents, and my dad's a preacher, there's pressure for any Christian parent when their kids aren't walking with God. I want you to know that's multiplied when your dad's the preacher. And especially in a small community. And his oldest son is not walking with God. There is pressure. I got to do something about this. His kid's messing up my ministry. My parents never did that. I do remember one day walking into my dad's office. My dad always kept a prayer journal. I remember seeing his list of things he was praying for. And at the top of the list, it said, Paul. They just lived that godly life in front of me. I couldn't deny that. And I was miserable. And my choices were having consequences. And I was getting in trouble. And I've shared some of those stories. Found myself in all kinds of situations that I did not like and didn't want to be in. It was all about my choices. And so what God does is, you know, he deals with the prodigal son. Sometimes we interfere. In fact, sometimes we save them from the consequences when we just need to back away and let God do his thing. Let me pause for a second, though. Maybe you're the prodigal this morning. I'm not pointing any finger. In fact, I don't know. And so you're saying, yeah, life really sucks right now. I'm about as miserable, and it's easy to come here and put on the pretend. But you know, in reality, your life, your heart is far from God right now. I just want you to know he loves you. He will pursue you. If you've never accepted his offer, you know, because you've always thought his offer is about becoming religious. It's about giving up all those things in your life that you think you enjoy. That's what God's like. He wants to get a hold of you because he's got some little grass hut down in Africa that he wants to send you to. It's got your name on it and that. That's not God. He wants you because he loves you. And he knows the consequences. He knows the way sin and wrong choices and ungodly actions mess up the life. And he knows you're miserable right now. And he knows you're finding out. You've tried all these avenues and directions. And every time you got to the end of one thing, this is the one. This is what I want. If I can reach that, attain that, I will finally be satisfied. And you've over and over again reached it and attained it and found out it was not what you thought. And he knows that. And he's saying, I have what you want. And in fact, all those choices and the ones that you know were not right choices, I want to forgive them. I want to wipe the slate clean. Just let me apply what my son did on the cross. He died for your sins in your place. Let me apply that to your sins so I can forgive you. And you can become part of my family, and together we'll move forward. That's what he wants. That's the good news. But back to the story here. So, you know, we could spend a lot of time, and you probably all, maybe most of you at one point or another, studied that first son. But I want us to focus, as we bring things to a close this morning, on the second son. Look at verses 26 through 31 again. So he called one of the servants and asked him, this is verse 25 actually. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called. By the way, you notice that dancing? I didn't know we were supposed to do that, but it's here. They're dancing. And so he called one of the servants and asked him, what was going on? Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. Now this servant got it. There's a reason to celebrate. Your brother's come back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father says, you're always with me. In fact, let's stop there for a moment. So we have another lost son here. And we hear what the lost son is saying. And if you're honest, or if I'm honest with myself, we get it, don't we? We get it. We get what he's ticked off about. We understand. Heck, we probably said it. You know, I stuck with you. I did the right thing. I've worked hard. I've been the good person. I didn't do fill in the blank. I never was. Eugene Peterson says that, but this son is triply lost. He's lost to his father, lost to his brother, and lost to the celebrating community. Here's what I find interesting about the son. There's so much we could look at, but what I want to focus on a few things. Remember, the father didn't go after the first son. Remember that? But he does go after this son. That was really interesting. What's going on? Why does he pursue this son? I have a couple of thoughts. Obviously, I wouldn't bring the question up if I didn't at least have my own thoughts about it. That would be dangerous. Like I said before, prodigals tend to be reminded of their battles, their lostness. They tend to see the ramifications because they're walking through the experiences of their choices in their life. And so they don't really need somebody. God's doing plenty of reminding for them. But self-righteous are convinced they've arrived. Oh, I would never say I'm perfect, certainly, but I've got it pretty much together now. I've got my act going right. I'm making good choices. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. Someone's got to step into their life and shake them up and say, wait a minute, you're missing it. I love this quote. For as long as we hold on to any pretense of having it all together, we are prevented from deepening and maturing in the Christian faith. For as long as we avoid recognition of our lostness, we are prevented from experiencing the elegant profundities of foundness. For as long as we insist on maintaining safe moral grids in which we always know where we stand and everyone else, these poses of self-sufficiency, we disenfranchise ourselves from the company of the found sheep, the found coin, two found brothers, and celebrating angels. You see, Satan loves it when God's people move into self-righteousness. What do we learn about the self-righteous in this parable? Let me quickly just walk through them. I think one of the things we see is one of the signs of if I'm becoming self-righteous or am self-righteous is anger and indignation is always our default. The older brother becomes angry. I can't enjoy the success of others. I can't enjoy the success of other Christians. I can't enjoy the success of other churches. I can't be, I'm just because they don't deserve it like I do. God, don't you see what I'm doing? Don't you see how consistent my life is? How godly I am? I have devotions every morning. And so why do they get blessed and you're not allowing me to have those blessings? Why should this good thing happen to them and not to me? So that's a default for self-righteous that can never understand why God does something good for someone else when obviously they're the ones that should have it. Number two, self-righteous refuse to allow themselves to celebrate when they see a sinner turn towards God. They just can't celebrate it. In fact, you'll hear a conversation like this. Isn't that exciting? So-and-so came to know the Lord. Well, it's really too early to tell, you know. Maybe, but let's watch. Let's see. I got to see some fruit before I really am sure because they're a pretty bad dude. They can't let it go. They can't rejoice. They can't relax and just assume that this is good. He refused to go in. Verse 28. Third, the self-righteous are convinced that they've proven their superiority, their worthiness. They would never say it. But the reality is they're expecting, you know, in fact they tell you, you don't have to thank me for that. But if you didn't, I can't believe. I mean, didn't they see what I did? Didn't they see the sacrifice we made? Didn't they see, you know, and they didn't even thank me. So it's this pretend game because to look righteous, I got to act humble. But in reality, I'm pretty ticked off that you didn't notice what I did, what a good person I am. They've convinced that they've proven their worthiness. Look at verse 29. All these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. Number four, the self-righteous keep close track of the sins of others. Verse 30, this son of yours has squandered your property with prostitutes. Now, that's interesting. Do you see anywhere in the context where it says that that's what took place? It does say he lived while living. And it's funny, I've heard it preached this way, but that's not what we hear. Nowhere else does it say that. Maybe in the confession of the son to his father, maybe he did say that. But we don't see it anywhere in the context. But the older son's making a point. You know, he's adding a little bit of information. But here's where I want us to end. Notice the father's responses to his son, to the lost son here. His first response is, son, don't you understand? The biggest gift I could ever possibly give you is a relationship. If you had nothing else, the fact that you and I have had a good relationship, that's enough. Verse 31, my son, father said, you're always with me. And he's not saying this, oh, you've always been around. No, it's a celebration. Don't you understand? I love that you're my son. I love that you stayed here, you know, and didn't put me through that heartache. And I love the fact that we've had this ongoing relationship. That's the big deal. Son, I celebrate that I had that with you every day. And I want you to celebrate that. And then secondly, don't you know everything I have is yours? Everything I have is yours. There's two things I think to take note of here. Number one, this son has a perspective of entitlement. But the reality is, it's all the father's. You hear that in the statement, don't you? It's all mine. But I shared it all with you. It's all yours, too. Exactly what God says to us when we accept that gift. He says, you are my family. You have the same inheritance that my son Jesus had. It's all yours. It's all by grace. I didn't deserve it. And it's interesting. The older son earlier, look back a couple verses. He said about his younger son, brother, he took what was yours and squandered it. He recognized it in his younger brother. It wasn't mine. It was, but when it comes to me, I deserve it. This is mine. And he says, no, it was always mine, but I've made it yours. There's no entitlement here for any of us. It's the grace of God. You haven't earned your righteousness any more than I have. It's the grace of God. We stepped into His family because we accepted a gift that came totally free, because if there were any kind of conditions, none of us would have got it. It all came from the Father. It's interesting, this parable leaves us hanging. We don't know what the son, this older son, ever did. We know the lost sheep was found. We know the lost coin was found. We know the first lost son returned. We don't know how it went with the second lost son. The conclusion isn't drawn. Did the Pharisees get it? Did they get to the? Did they have that aha moment where they said, "Oh, that's us. We thought it was about us, and it's not. It's about God." I don't know. Did they see their own lostness in the midst of the story? Did they see that as easy it was for them to identify the sins of everyone else, they'd missed this huge thing in their life called self-righteousness? Did they remember, I am what I am by the grace of God? Did they get it? I don't know. Do we get it? The jury's still out. In fact, when it comes to self-righteousness, the jury is always out. Because the potential is always there. So the story goes on for you and I as well. If God allows us to get put in this spot where almost 30,000 vehicles go by every day, and if He allows us to begin to attract people who do not know God, who are lost, who are tax collectors and sinners, and He starts bringing them into our doors, and we get to reach to our community like we want to, and join the other churches in this city that are trying to do the same thing. As those folks begin to come into our gatherings that haven't walked the walk, that haven't talked the talk, that haven't made the sacrifices that you're making right now, you are, and paid the cost, that'll be the test. Because if we remember, neither did we. God was gracious. Let's pray. Jeez, God, when I started into these parables, I thought you were going to talk about someone else. I thought you were going to talk about those prodigals that are out there, and you switched it on us. And you talked about me. And how easy it is to start thinking that somehow I deserve, I earned, I've got it together. I'm the one that's doing the right thing. And how easy it is for me to look at those individuals out there that lives are struggling because of choices they're making, and look down at them and forget that I am what I am by the grace and mercy of God. We're so grateful for what you've done in our lives. We're so grateful for what you're doing for us as a church family. You've already blown away our expectations. And we're just getting going. But in the midst of that, it would be really easy at some point for us to start thinking, I deserve this. And become that last lost son. Don't let that happen to us as a church family. Don't let that happen to us as individuals. Thank you for your word. Boy, we need your word. It does dig right into where we are. So thanks for the time in it this morning. And thanks for this opportunity we're going to have in a few moments when we go over to the school, the ones that can, and we have some prayer together and just talk a little bit about what you're doing. Just thanks for that opportunity to celebrate. Help us to be wise as we walk through this. And we pray these things in your son's name. Amen. Let's sing a song together and we'll close. Thank you.